From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Good Weekend Talks, and I'm Conrad Marshall. Join us as we take a deep dive into the definitive stories of the day, brought to life here and in the pages of Good Weekend magazine. In our inaugural episode, we're exploring an often fatal genetic condition known as mitochondrial disease. Good Weekend senior writer Tim Elliott explored the little-known illness, in particular the push for a controversial form of IVF that would allow sufferers to have healthy children. Today, Good Weekend editor Katrina Strickland will be joining Tim and Sean Murray, a carrier of the disease and founding director and CEO of the Mito Foundation. But first, actor Nick English will read the story in full. So sit back and listen to Cell Block, the controversial IVF procedure bringing hope to sufferers of a rare disease.
One morning in 2005, Shelley Beverly woke up to find that she had gone deaf. She was 21 and living in Johannesburg with her older brother Neil. "I was very scared," she says. "It was just so sudden." She struggled through the rest of the day, hoping that her hearing would come back, but it didn't. In one sense, her hearing loss wasn't entirely a surprise. Beverly's grandmother had been deaf. Neil had lost his hearing when he was 13, and her mum, Mary, had lost hers when she was 32. "We knew it ran in the family," she says, "but I thought I'd been lucky and not inherited it." Beverly, 35, lives in Margate, a semi-rural district of Hobart, with her husband James. The couple migrated to Australia from South Africa in 2010, looking for space, buying 2.5 hectares of lush green grass at the foot of a forested ridge near the mouth of the Derwent River. "We love the wildlife here," says James, looking out the living room window. "We've seen paddy melons, echidnas, quolls, blue-tongued lizards, even a Tassie devil." At dusk, hundreds of kangaroos emerge from the forest to gorge on the grass. "It's very peaceful," says James. "It's really helped us after everything that's happened." Apart from their deafness, Beverly's family had largely enjoyed good health. Her mother, Mary, then 62, started experiencing fatigue and stomach pain. Doctors in Durban ordered a colonoscopy, but the procedure made her worse. Her feet became swollen and purple. Because of their hearing problems, Shelley and Mary had communicated mainly in text messages. "But soon I began noticing that her wording got a little bit funny," says Beverly. "It didn't always make sense." Beverly flew to Durban in February 2016, but by that time her mother could no longer talk or walk. She was so weak that she couldn't move her hands or lift her neck. 2 days after Beverly arrived in Durban, her mother caught a virus that caused fluid to build up on her lungs. The doctors tried unsuccessfully to drain it. Shortly afterwards, she died. She weighed just 36 kilograms. "It was so fast," Beverly says, "and we were still in the dark about what she had." Shortly before Mary's death, Neil had also fallen ill. He developed a number of mysterious symptoms, including facial twitches and seizures. He kept falling over and tripping, and experienced vomiting and headaches so severe he lost his vision for weeks at a time. His behaviour became strange, showering with his clothes on and hallucinating. One day, Dad was driving him around and Neil started talking to all these little people he thought were around his feet, says Beverly. Doctors in Durban had trouble diagnosing him, so they sent a biopsy to London, where he was found to have a type of mitochondrial cytopathy, one of a large family of chronic and progressive diseases that affects the muscles, brain, and nervous system. As the family soon learnt, the condition has no cure and no effective therapies. One of the common early symptoms is hearing loss. Neil died in June 2017, aged 34, by which time Beverly had discovered she also had the condition. "It was fear. So much fear," she says. She began experiencing symptoms, including migraines and vision loss. She has since developed diabetes, hypertension, gastroparesis, and pharyngeal dysphagia. "Every time I get sick now, the flu or something, I think, when am I going to need a wheelchair or a feeding tube? When will my legs stop working?" Beverly has bright blue eyes and long, straight, ash-brown hair. She's got a lazy left eye and uncommonly pale skin, which she attributes to her condition. "Oh, and I had bunions out in 2010, she says, laughing wryly. She doesn't know how long she's got left, but she's determined to make it count. She's joined Mito Awareness Groups and is an active member of the Mito Foundation, which supports sufferers and funds research. She has exhaustively researched the condition and takes every opportunity to educate doctors. You'd be surprised how little they know about it, she says. But her overriding focus has been on a cutting-edge and currently illegal procedure called mitochondrial donation, a form of IVF which would allow those with the condition to have children, safe in the knowledge that they would not be passing it on. Mito has taken everything from me, she says. If I die, at least James will still have a part of me. I would like him to look at our child and say, you have your mum's smile or your mum's eyes. Mitochondrial donation has been labelled immoral and unethical, a slippery slope to designer babies, not to mention potentially unsafe. The only country in the world to have legalised it is the UK. A report by medical experts into the technology's potential application in Australia is due to be delivered to Health Minister Greg Hunt this month. This fight is really personal to me, Beverly says. Short of a cure, people with Mito should at least have the option of having healthy children. Mitochondria are microscopic structures in human cells that provide the body with energy. For this reason, they are often described as the cell's powerhouse. They are crucially important. If your mitochondria fail or mutate, your body will be starved of energy, causing multiple organ failure and premature death. Mito, which is maternally inherited, usually affects the muscles and major organs such as the brain, heart, liver, inner ears, and eyes. But it can cause any symptom to any organ at any age. Indeed, the term mito includes more than 200 disorders, the symptoms of which are maddeningly varied and seemingly unrelated, leading to delayed diagnoses or incorrect diagnoses or indeed no diagnosis. Many of these people have been fobbed off by doctors or laughed off by people who think they are hypochondriacs, says Dr. David Thorburn, a mitochondrial researcher at Murdoch Children's Research Institute in Melbourne, who has diagnosed some 700 cases over the past 28 years. Most people are relieved to finally know what it is, because that is the end of that part of their journey. Up to 2 million people worldwide have some form of mito. In Australia, about 60 children are born every year with the condition, most of whom will die before the age of 5. Others, like Beverly, who have a less severe type of the disease, will get adult onset and can expect to become ill in their 30s, 40s, or 50s. According to Thornburn, one of the things that most dismays families with mito is the lack of control they have over passing the condition down to future generations of their family. Remaining childless is one way to stop the condition from being passed down, as is adopting. But as Thornburn acknowledges, there is an innate desire in many individuals to have their own children. For these people, mito donation offers the very real prospect that the condition is eliminated from future generations. Mitochondrial replacement is a highly specialized procedure, requiring a level of manual dexterity sufficient to manipulate a woman's egg, which is roughly the width of a human hair. Within the egg is a nucleus, where a person's genes are located, and the cytoplasm, the jelly-like substance that surrounds it. Mitochondria are found in the cytoplasm. Mitochondrial replacement involves taking a donor female's healthy egg, removing its nucleus, and replacing it with the nucleus of the woman affected by mitochondrial disease, but whose nucleus is healthy. The egg is then fertilized using her partner's sperm. Another option is to fertilize the egg first and then swap the nucleus. The resulting embryo is then implanted into the mother. Since more than 99.9% of our genes are found in the egg's nucleus, which remains unaffected, the procedure will have no impact on the child's height, hair colour, or mannerisms. Despite that, it's sometimes said that babies produced as a result of mitochondrial donation would have three parents, the mother, the father, and the donor. The technology has been tested in mice for more than 30 years, but only since 2009 has research been done on human embryos, mainly in the UK. Almost from the start, the research was subject to sensational headlines about scientists playing God and the possibility of genetic engineering, with much of the hysteria being fueled by anti-abortion groups. The Catholic Church described it as a further step in the commodification of the human embryo and a failure to respect new individual human lives. In 2012, the Human Genetics Alert, an independent watchdog group in London, wrote a paper comparing any baby produced with mitochondrial replacement to Frankenstein's creation, since they would be produced by sticking together bits from many different bodies. According to the Conservative British MP, Jacob Rees-Mogg, the procedure was not a cure for disease, it is the creating of a different person. Regulators subjected the technology to four separate scientific reviews, together with rounds of ethical debate and community consultation. In 2015, the UK Parliament voted to legalise technology for use in humans, on the proviso that it only be available to those women at high risk of passing on the disease. Since then, 13 couples in the UK have received the go-ahead to undergo the procedure. It's unclear how many children, if any, have been born. The parents have asked that details not be published. Meanwhile, scientists like Thorburn wait eagerly for news of any developments. I know the UK researchers well and have asked several of them, and they are keeping completely quiet about it in respecting the family's wishes, he says. If there have been babies born in the UK using the procedure, they aren't the first. In April 2016, a child was born using the technique in Mexico to a Jordanian mother who carried a fatal mitochondrial condition known as Leigh syndrome. The doctor in charge, an American fertility specialist called Dr. John Zhang, later admitted that he had gone to Mexico because the procedure is illegal in America. In Mexico, he admitted, there are no rules. Even those who want mitochondrial donation legalized in Australia concede that much remains unknown about the procedure. Its long-term risks can only be understood through lifelong health checkups. But this is impossible until any children conceived via this procedure become adults. Implications for subsequent generations also remain unclear. No medical procedure is 100% safe, says Sean Murray, CEO of the Mito Foundation. But we think we are at the stage now where the benefits of the technology are greater than the risks. One of the issues around safety concerns the compatibility of the donor's mitochondria with the recipient's nuclear genes. A 2016 study in mice suggested that mismatched mitochondria affected their metabolism and shortened their lives. Another concern is known as carryover, whereby a tiny amount of mutant mitochondria is inevitably transferred from the affected mother's egg into the donor egg during the procedure. Instead of it being wiped out, the mutation might then reappear in the descendants of any girls born as a result. For this reason, some people have proposed that the procedure be restricted to male embryos only, but this raises all kinds of ethical issues around selective breeding and sex selection. Indeed, it often seems as if the term ethical minefield was coined especially with mitochondrial donation in mind. My primary ethical concern has to do with the sanctity of human life, says Father Kevin McGovern, a Catholic priest and member of the National Health and Medical Research Council's Mitochondrial Donation Expert Working Committee. If mitochondrial donation is permitted here, the technique most likely to be used is pronuclear transfer, which requires that both the donor's egg and the affected mother's egg be fertilized. This is to ensure that both eggs are at the same developmental stage. But once the nucleus is removed from the donor's fertilized egg, it is discarded. For people who believe that life begins at conception, this is akin to murder. You are creating two lives and destroying one for spare parts. The Catholic Church has consistently opposed mitochondrial donation. In a Senate inquiry into the technology in 2018, Dr. Bernadette Tobin, director of the Plunkett Centre for Ethics at the Australian Catholic University, suggested the process was intrinsically evil. The inquiry also heard from Father Anthony Fisher, Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, who raised concerns about the moral right of the child to know how he or she was conceived, the problem of what he called genealogical bewilderment, and the donor's right to remain anonymous. He was also worried that women might effectively become egg vending machines. The availability of human ova is often assumed when people talk about reproductive technology, as if they were somehow there in a cupboard to be used. In fact, it means women have to be used to obtain these eggs. They are extracted by invasive procedures that do carry some risk. Equally troubling for the Australian Catholic Bishops' Conference, the peak national body for the church's bishops, was the fact that mitochondrial donation involved conceiving babies not by marital intercourse, but by a technical procedure. Most of these concerns are redundant. argues the Mito Foundation's Sean Murray. We already have a well-defined regulatory framework for dealing with all this, he says. As far as the donor's right to remain anonymous, we would defer to the appropriate federal or state and territory regulations that apply for sperm or egg donations. In regard to a kid's right to know they had a mitochondrial donor, societally, there seems to be a preference to inform kids. It's important for them to understand their genetic lineage. Then there's the matter of consent. The parents can wrestle with the ethical issues and weigh up all the risks, but the only person who can't consent to the procedure is the unborn child. Well, says Murray, they can't consent to being born with mito either. Murray, 47, is one of the founding directors of the Mito Foundation, which was established in Sydney in 2009. Mito runs in my family, he says. My older brother, Peter, died of it in 2009 at 45, and my mum passed away in 2011 at 70. What people often don't understand is that even in families that have mito, each member can have different mutational loads, basically different amounts of bad mitochondria. Peter got a high load, but I didn't. That's why I'm still here. A computer scientist by training, Murray now works full-time on the foundation. Much of his job involves travelling around the country, explaining mito to politicians, journalists, and philanthropists, raising funds for research and, most crucially, advocating for a change to the laws. Mitochondrial donation falls foul of two pieces of legislation: the Research Involving Human Embryos Act, 2002, and the Prohibition of Human Cloning for Reproduction Act, 2002. The laws prohibit the implantation of a human embryo that contains more than two people's genetic material. The laws were subject to a mandatory review in 2010, but the then Labor government recommended they remain the same. In 2013, the Mito Foundation urged the government to revisit its decision. 2 years later, it began lobbying in earnest. What we tried to get across was that the science around mito donation has come a long way since 2010. Also, the process that the UK went through to legalise it really reassured us that the procedure is safe and effective. In the past 5 years, Murray and his colleagues have consulted with more than 100 MPs and senators. Only one of them, according to Murray, said, "I don't like this." They have also talked to dozens of industry experts, including academics and medical and research bodies, about the benefits of mitochondrial donation. Most of them get it straight away, he says. We are talking about a technique that will prevent the chance of having a morbidly ill child. Now, a breakthrough appears imminent. In February 2019, Health Minister Greg Hunt asked National Health and Medical Research Council to look into the matter, review the science, and conduct public consultation. The NHMRC is due to hand its report to Hunt this month. The expectation among the mito community is that he will recommend the laws be changed. Any proposals would then need to be debated in Parliament, where issues around reproductive medicine have, in the past, been hotly contested. Murray expects some opposition from more conservative MPs, but nothing like the rancour seen in the New South Wales Parliament during last year's debate over legalising abortion. Shadow Health Minister Chris Bowen has, for his part, said that Labor will support changing the laws. Whether this will help people like Shelley Beverley is unclear. If Hunt gives it the green light, it will take 2 years at least for mitochondrial donation to become available to prospective parents. Given the time involved in drafting and passing legislation, establishing a regulatory regime, and getting doctors up to speed with the technology, this will probably be too late for Beverley. I really only have about a year left to give it a go, she tells me. After that, my symptoms may progress and biologically things get worse after 35. She says she would consider going to the UK for the treatment, but that at present they are not accepting international patients. In the meantime, she watches TV and reads a little, but not too much. It puts me to sleep. She gardens. She has a bed of huge white and pink roses at the back of her house as a memorial to her mother and brother. And she eats. James cooks for me. He lets me choose the best meat and potatoes. I've put on weight since I've met him. She describes James as something close to an angel. He will listen to every problem I have or feeling I experience. He will always put me first. Beverley started going out with James when she was 21, right around the time she first went deaf. I was so scared that he wouldn't like me as much. I remember calling him and saying I was scared he would leave me. But James is still here. I'm very lucky to have him, she says. If I go, I want him to have a part of me.
If you're enjoying this podcast, please remember to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. And remember to rate and comment on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, my name's Katrina Strickland. I'm the editor of Good Weekend. I'm here today with Tim Elliott, senior writer for Good Weekend, and Sean Murray, chief executive of the Mito Foundation. Welcome, Tim and Sean.
Hi. Hello there, Katrina.
Tim, you found it quite difficult, I think, trying to summarise in layman's terms what mitochondria are, let alone what mitochondrial disease are. So let's try it for the audience here.
It was a real crash course for me because I think my science education stopped at about year 9 or year 8 at school.
But don't you remember mitochondria from school? It's funny, isn't it? It's one of the words you remember.
You remember mitochondria? I don't remember mitochondria.
It's the energy thing.
I don't remember.
Some people do. Most don't, I'd say.
So I was hopeless, but I had some great help from Sean. He was brilliant. But look, mitochondria are, in summary, basically they're the microscopic structures in human cells that provide the body with energy. And this is why they're sometimes described as the cell's powerhouse. And they're really important. If your mitochondria fail or mutate, your body will be starved of energy, causing multiple organ failure and premature death in many cases.
Right, yeah. So not a good disease to have at all. So, Sean, tell us about mitochondrial donation. What is it and what's it used for?
So mitochondrial donation is a technique that is built on IVF, and it's a technique that can reduce the risk of a woman who's affected by mitochondrial disease, reduce her chances of passing that disease on to her children. The way that's done is it basically replacing an affected woman's unhealthy mitochondria in her egg with healthy mitochondria from a donor. By bringing in healthy mitochondria, you're vastly reducing the chances of her child having that mitochondrial disease that it will possibly otherwise get if it has the mitochondria from the affected mother.
Tim, tell us about the controversy around this. Who's upset about it and why? I know in your story you talked about the term ethical minefield.
Well, I think the major objections come from anti-abortion groups, medical ethical groups, but mostly, I guess, from the Catholic Church. They object to the fact that in the most commonly used mitochondrial replacement therapy, there has to be two eggs that are fertilised. One of the eggs has its nucleus removed and it has to be discarded. So for people who believe that life begins at conception, that's akin to murder. And so that's why the Catholic Church are totally opposed to it. They believe that doctors will be using eggs for spare parts, you know, using bits and pieces. And in fact, that's what a lot of the medical, a lot of ethics groups in the UK have said as well. It's, you know, Frankenstein's babies because it's using bits and pieces from different people, which is not strictly true. It's using a tiny, tiny percentage of genetic material from the donor.
And there's also the issue, isn't there, about there haven't been enough children born from this procedure to really know what the ramifications are on their health.
To really know what its effects will be, you have to do regular health checkups for life on babies born from the procedure. But obviously you can't do those checks at the moment because there's only been one or two babies that we know of born worldwide and they're not adults yet, so you can't check how they're progressing. So that's one objection.
Well, that's a pretty strong one, isn't it, really? Sean?
Well, absolutely. I mean, with any new medical intervention, it's got to start somewhere. I think we need to remember that a lot of research and a lot of experimentation has been done in this, in cell lines and in animal models, etc. So it's not as though we're starting from an idea and going straight to inhuman application here. So it is a bit. It has been a very well considered and a very well researched technique. But there is no way of knowing the long-term implications until it's been in place for the long term. But all the indications are at this stage that it appears to be safe.
It was funny how David, in the process of writing the piece, David Thorburn, the doctor in Melbourne, who's the specialist in this technology, told me that he knows the people in the UK who've been using this technology and rolling it out with these 13 very special couples who've had an opportunity to use it. And he's been quietly kind of asking and hinting, and he's desperate to know because it's such an interesting for him. It's totally cutting edge. So he's desperate to know, and he's been asking these doctors involved in the trial about it just quietly, and none of them will disclose anything. They're being very tight-lipped.
Top secret. And you also said, which I thought was fascinating because we don't often look at the manual aspects of surgery, that the human egg is thinner than a hair, and therefore if you're going to be a specialist in this, you have to be really manually dexterous. I mean, that's fascinating.
I just think, yeah, because with all these procedures, I sort of, with any of these procedures that involve IVF, or I just sort of look at it and go, how the hell do they do surgery on something as small as a human egg, or even a cell, which is way smaller? I mean, a human egg is massive compared to a human cell, but even then a human egg is only the width of a human hair. So to get involved and try and manipulate these microscopic structures and accurately implant them, I just think it's, you know, it's micro manipulation. It must be incredibly difficult. How do they do it, Sean?
Well, I don't know is the answer, but I've seen a video of it and it's phenomenal.
And so we, in Tim's story, basically the report from the National Health and Medical Research Council was going to go to Health Minister Greg Hunt this month. Do you know if he's received that yet?
I'm not sure, but as far as I know, it's due by, right, by the end of March. Yeah.
And then he will make a decision on whether to recommend it or not. How much of a Barney then do you think there would be in federal parliament over it, given, as Tim has flagged, there's huge ethical issues and there's huge concerns for those who think the sanctity of life starts at conception?
Well, so the Mito Foundation's been actively working with government on this for a number of years now. I think what we found is once the technique is described and we talk about what it is, we talk about what this these mitochondria are and what they do, and the fact that this isn't, we're not trying to create designer babies, and it's very different to gene editing. We hear about CRISPR babies and genetically modified babies. It's very different to all of that. I think once we get over the sensationalism, the only thing the Mito Foundation is advocating that this be used for is to prevent children being born with catastrophic diseases. And I think once we get to that point, most people think, okay, well, that makes sense then. By and large, I think people understand that this is all about giving women who are at risk a choice of having a healthy baby that's related to them.
I mean, I think it was Bernadette Tobin, right, in one of the Senate hearings who described the process as intrinsically evil. Can you explain why she would have said that?
Yeah, it was a bit of a backhanded insult. And that's it's something that was on record in a submission made by her organisation to a Senate inquiry into this matter that was undertaken in 2018. That's their position. They're against these sorts of, against IVF generally. And even what was seen in the UK, there was a lot of conjecture being thrown up about the scientific questions and how can we guarantee safety and how can we guarantee that the children won't get mitochondrial disease, etc., coming from people in these types of organisations. And it was an interesting point in the UK process where these particular people who were against the technique, who came from a religious background, were asked, okay, you're raising all these scientific questions, but if we could guarantee safety, would you still be against it? And their answer was, yes.
Some of the submissions from the Catholic Church were just extraordinary. One of the objections was that the process was creating babies that came not from marital intercourse and from a scientific procedure. And I just thought that was hilarious from, you know, basically.
That horse is bolted.
That horse is bolted, but also that's coming from a bunch of men who don't have sex. I just thought it was just hilarious. Some of the real life issues and the theological issues are just so mismatched and so extraordinarily out of sync. It's just sometimes beyond belief. What really blows me away was when I was interviewing the people in this story, Shelley Beverly, this woman in a case study, poor woman whose whole family has been decimated by mito, lost a mother, lost a brother, now she's got it. So she's 35 and she's looking toward another couple of decades of intense pain and suffering. And I, having seen her brother and sister go through the same, her brother and mother die in the most ugly circumstances, I just couldn't believe, you know, she's dealing with the most fearful stuff. You know, her terror when I talked to her was really palpable. So I was really fascinated how these people handle that fear, that incredible fear. I guess you must have seen that heaps, right?
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. I'm amazed and really encouraged. It turns people, you know, in all different ways. Some people shut down and go away and close down. And other people just, like Shelley, in your story, Shelley's a phenomenal human. She's one of those people who is doing, she's doing so much for this Maito community. She's a psychologist by training, and she's bringing her skills and expertise in that area to help people cope and manage with their disease. So you see people time and time again who are faced with this situation of mitochondrial disease, who really are able to step up and want to do things for others to help them. And I'm constantly amazed and, you know, encouraged by what some people have the capacity to do.
And actually, that was one of the most poignant parts at the end of your story, Tim, was that even if this legislation is passed, it's really going to be too late for her, because she's 35. By the time it's passed, she'll be 37. Her symptoms might have got worse. It's kind of unlikely that she'll be able to access it. Is that right, Sean?
I know for Shelley that her times, you know, the window of opportunity for her is closing rapidly. So that's why we at the Foundation are imploring the government to act on this and act quickly. It's been a year since the inquiries that the National Health and Medical Research Council are undertaken, and that was about 18 months after the Senate inquiry. So things aren't happening very quickly, and every single week in Australia alone, there's another child who's born who will ultimately die from mitochondrial disease that could possibly have been prevented.
You've done a pretty amazing job raising the awareness, haven't you? Because it's a small percentage of the population that's affected, and yet I think you've done the Bloody Long Walk. Did you create that?
Yeah, the Bloody Long Walk was an idea created by the Maito Foundation. It was after our first sort of awareness raising event we called Stay in Bed Day, which we thought was fantastic and was going to be the next next Red Nose Day.
Like,
and the reason being that people with mitochondrial disease, one of the key symptoms is that they're fatigued, and so we thought staying in bed makes sense. But we found that you know, lost traction after a while, so we thought we should do something else. So we went to the other
extreme.
I can't
believe that lost traction. It's the one charity I could get on board.
I know. Well, who knows? The opportunity could present again.
Yeah, exactly.
We're reviving Stay in Bed Day. So, yes, we've been doing Bloody Long Walks now since 2013. We had one walk in 2013, 300 people took part. That's our hook to get people into this cause and join the Maito movement, as we call it.
How much did you raise last year?
Last year we raised $3.5 million.
Yeah, that's great.
So we're hoping, our plans were that we would be raising $4 million this year to pump into supporting patients and their families and to driving research. So we'll see how these events go, shall we?
Well, that's right. Everything's a bit in flux at the moment.
When this COVID thing started going bananas a little while ago, I thought, oh my God, how's she going to, if she gets it, I mean, it's really scary for people like that. Shelley was just, she's a very fragile human being. She's so brave.
A lot of people with mitochondrial disease are particularly impacted by respiratory viruses. They, you know, tend to fall further and take a longer time to recover. So absolutely, there are members of the community who would be more at risk in terms of what the disease could cause for them. There's certainly not any more risk of contracting the disease, but than the general public.
But they'd certainly be much more knocked around, right?
Yeah, exactly. The Maito community in Australia, or everywhere really, is one that has to be paying particular attention to, you know, avoiding it as best they can.
All right. Well, I think that's all we have time for. Thank you, Sean. And thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Katrina.
Subscriptions power our writers. To support independent journalism, search Subscribe Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. This episode of Good Weekend Talks was produced and edited by Anu Hasbold, with editorial assistance by Conrad Marshall. Technical assistance by Cormac Lally, with casting by Catapult. Tom McKendrick is head of audio, and Katrina Strickland is the editor of Good Weekend. I'm Conrad Marshall. Thanks for listening.